world without bugs is a world where we drown in our own waste.
In terms of waste, I mean, that's one of the kind of least glamorous but most important things that insects do, is essentially break down the stuff we don't want around. Dead bodies, feces. So a lot of that kind of unflashy, ungarlanded work is done by beetles out of sight and out of mind for us most of the time. But if they weren't to do it, we would certainly notice it. One of the researchers I spoke to for the book said we'd be living in a world full of poo with dead Uncle Jeremy floating on by us.
That's Oliver Millman. We talk with him about his book, The Insect Crisis, The Fall of the Tiny Empires That Run the World. It's a devastating examination of how collapsing insect populations worldwide threaten everything from wild birds to the food on our plate. Then we round out today's episode with some practical advice on how to make your lawn and garden pollinator-friendly. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Do you like birds? How about eating? Would you like to continue being able to do that? The end of birds, the end of food, and the end of complex life as we know it. That's the catastrophe we face if we continue to lose insect populations around the world, as we're doing at an alarming pace. 3 out of every 4 of our planet's known animal species are insects. In The Insect Crisis, journalist Oliver Millman dives into the torrent of recent evidence that suggests that the insect kingdom is suffering the greatest existential crisis in its 400 million year history. What's causing the insect apocalypse? Why does it pose such a threat to us? And what can be done to stem the loss of the miniature empires that hold life aloft as we know it? Oliver Millman, environment correspondent for The Guardian, tells us all about it. Oliver Millman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Great to be with you. Hi.
This book, The Insect Crisis, in the first pages, you paint a shocking portrait of what the world will be like if the insects vanish. One that's actually been haunting me ever since I read it. It's actually keeping me up at night. Basically, the insects are the sanitation engineers of the planet. I mean, just this fact alone, without getting into issues about how our food system depends on them. So we would be overwhelmed by our waste. Talk about what the planet would look like if the insects were gone.
Yeah, I'm sorry for the gloomy start of the book, but I kind of wanted to kind of focus people's minds, I suppose, on the importance of insects, because it often escapes us, doesn't it? How important they are to us and the world around us, really, and how it functions. I mean, essentially, a world without insects isn't one we want to live in, and it isn't one we'd be able to live in. The biologist E.O. Wilson, who passed away earlier this year, he estimated it would only last a few months without insects. So it isn't a place we would thrive and survive in very long. In terms of waste, I mean, you mentioned that. I mean, that's one of the kind of least glamorous but most important things that insects do, is essentially break down the stuff we don't want around. Dead bodies, feces, and so on, kind of blowflies and beetles get in there before bacteria finish off the job. So a lot of that kind of unflashy, ungarlanded work is done by beetles out of sight and out of mind for us most of the time. But if they weren't to do it, we would certainly notice it. One of the researchers I spoke to for the book said we'd be living in a world full of poo with dead Uncle Jeremy floating on by us. We would certainly notice a world without insects when it comes to waste disposal. The other important thing, of course, from that waste disposal is what then happens. I mean, they break down waste, and then it's cycled, the nutrients are then cycled through the environment. So forests and grasslands and other natural environments are kept healthy and replenished because of the work the insects do. It's all being done all of the time in the background or around the world, of course, done without thanks and without payment by insects. But we would certainly miss it if it wasn't done.
You also paint a world in which, you know, in the first months of this happening, that birds' withered corpses would be strewn on the ground. You know, some 3 billion birds have gone missing in North America. You cite some statistics from Germany where there's been a terrible decline as well. Talk about the connection between insects and birds. I mean, I think it should be pretty obvious, but I think a lot of people love birds but hate insects, and they don't make that connection.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of entomologists are thinking about that connection when trying to raise alarm about the insect crisis, because it might be hard to get people to be particularly alarmed about a certain type of beetle. But they will be quite alarmed about the loss of birds, because we have kind of natural fascination with birds. We generally think quite fondly of them. So the loss of birds is certainly something that grabs the attention. And it's something that's happening in many places around the world where researchers are looking now. Like you mentioned, there's research coming out of Germany and France and Canada, and even in the half of the Amazon rainforest, you're seeing insect-eating birds decline more quickly than omnivorous birds. So we're losing things like warblers and swallows and bluebirds, those animals that really depend on insects in their diet, more quickly than we're losing kind of crows and starlings and other birds like that that don't need insects as much as them. So, yeah, it's a really important point to make when we're thinking about the role of insects, because they do all this important ecological work themselves, but they also form the basis of the food chain in most ecologies around the world. And once you start yanking away large numbers of insects from that base, you start to see things kind of become off kilter. And birds are suffering from that. It is increasingly clear, and we should expect that will cascade further. Amphibians obviously feed on insects, and then you go up the food chain, and we're part of that food chain. We're not separate from it, so we will be affected too.
Yeah, in fact, you say, or maybe you quote a scientist saying that, you know, within a few months, we basically would be starving to death.
Yeah, we would. I mean, insects help pollinate about a third of the foods we eat, and they're quite an important third if we think about what they do provide. It's the kind of fruit and vegetables, the colourful stuff on our plates that provide us with nutrition and vitamins and so on. So without that, you would be in a serious food security crisis. And I mean, this is in the scenario, of course, of losing all insects, which is kind of unthinkable. We're not quite there yet, but the United Nations has warned that there is a looming food security issue with the declines we're already seeing. We have a growing global population at the time of a pollination deficit. We're losing pollinators, not just bees, which are the most famous ones, of course, but butterflies and flies, beetles and other insects are really crucial for propagating our food crops. So if you like, almonds and melons and cherries, blueberries, I mean, even chocolate. Chocolate's pollinated by a tiny midge that gets into the cacao plant. All of these things are very important for our nutrition and our health, as well as our joy when we think about eating chocolate. So it's incredibly important we keep insects around in large numbers if we're going to continue the food security that much of the world has already.
You quote a scientist, I just want to read this out for my listeners because it's so stark. Within a few decades, the world would return to the state of a billion years ago, composed primarily of bacteria, algae, and a few very simple multicellular plants. That's quite terrifying. Talk more also about some of the other... I hate to be so human-centric, but unfortunately, this is often what it takes, you know, that we think of the world in terms of what it can do for us, not what we can do for the world. What about the role of insects in medicines? This was something that was new to me.
Yeah, it was new to me as well. I mean, there was a lot of new kind of revelations to me in writing this book in terms of insects' role, because I didn't think about them that much, really. Despite being an environmental journalist, you kind of get drawn to the big flashy creatures of our planet, the rhinos and the giraffes and the orangutans and the polar bears and so on. Insects' role kind of escaped me, really, until I really started digging into the research on this book. And yeah, one of the surprising things is their role in medicines. I mean, they have been used traditionally in medicines in places like China for many years, but now kind of Western science is starting to look into that more deeply, and they realize that insects really are a trove of undiscovered medicines. Cockroaches have properties that could be used to fight antibiotic resistance. For example, honey is an antioxidant. It can be useful in combating heart disease and skin problems. Bee venom can be used against certain cancers or even dandruff, according to some researchers. I mean, a lot of this work is still in the early stages, but there's a lot of promise in using insects for medicines. We've traditionally used plants and other things as sources for new medicines, but insects are this kind of vast, untapped potential laboratory of new treatments that we could be using if we utilize them properly.
You mentioned cockroaches, the kind of creature that most people shudder at when they see it running across the kitchen floor. What about some other insects that we love to hate, like mosquitoes? Do they have a use for humans?
Yeah, they do. I mean, everything on this planet has its role. As much as we kind of think about insects as these kind of brainless, buzzy things that annoy us sometimes or bite us, and, you know, I think a lot of us would be quite happily to press a button to get rid of all mosquitoes, but it would have some unintended consequences. I was speaking to a researcher for the book who was working for 20 years on finding new ways to wipe out insects through genetic modifications. And she said she had an epiphany one day when she looked under the microscope of a mosquito, and she thought it looked beautiful with its big eyes and its colorful wings. And she's kind of since reorientated her work towards finding ways to ensure that they do not carry disease through genetic modifications rather than simply killing them outright. Because as she pointed out, mosquitoes perform a role like everything else. They provide food for certain creatures, amphibians and birds and other things. They're pollinators themselves. They pollinate tansies and some other plants. And they're generally speaking, part of the web of life as we know it. Things probably wouldn't completely collapse if we got rid of mosquitoes. Don't want to overstate their importance, but you have to be careful when you're tinkering around with species and deciding which are good and which are bad. I think we assign those labels quite quickly, and we should pause for thought before doing so.
I remember when I first heard of the German study that first blew the whistle on the insect Armageddon. I didn't remember the exact date, but you have it in the book, Oliver Millman, in The Insect Crisis. It was October 18th, 2017. Tell us about that study and its impact.
Yeah, so I think it's fair to say that scientists were very keen on studying new types of insects. There's so many undiscovered insects, looking at behaviors and roles in ecology and so on, but very few are actually counting them, because what was the point? I mean, insects were everywhere. Why would you spend your valuable time and money to trap and count them? But that's what a team of entomologists actually did in Germany. They kind of had been trapping insects there for years, and they kind of realized they were actually sitting on this kind of treasure trove of data. And with a kind of team of other scientists, they kind of crunched the numbers. They managed to get consistent records going back to 1989, where they'd been trapping insects in 63 protected nature areas across Germany. So I'm not talking about in the heart of agricultural fields or in cities or anything. These are protected areas. And they realized anecdotally there had been a decline, but they wanted to look at the numbers. And the numbers are startling. I mean, since 1989, the annual average weight of flying insects caught in those traps had dropped by 76%. And in summer, when insects were at their peak, it was down 82%. So it really caused widespread shock and alarm in the scientific community. And that spilled out into the media. You started getting acquainted with the term insectageddon, insect apocalypse, and so on. Really, really quite startling numbers. And I think it made a lot of people think, well, if this is happening in Germany, in protected areas of Germany, what's the picture elsewhere? It's probably as bad, if not worse.
Talk about the rate of extinction among insects. You write in the book that it's 8 times faster than that of mammals and birds, with the total mass of the world's insects receding at 2.5% a year. What's the time horizon that we have to turn this around?
Yeah, there's been a couple of studies on this. One found that 2.5% a year decline. Another one said it was maybe a little lower, maybe 1% a year being lost. And there is incomplete data, of course, from around the world. We don't even know how many insects are out there in terms of number of species. So it's hard to actually ascertain what the levels of declines are in every part of the world. But every place we've been looking, by and large, has shown these kind of very steep declines. So the United Nations estimates that 500,000 species could be gone by the midpoint of this century. I think it's important to note that we're not going to lose every single type of insect. It's not like we're looking at, you know, a 2.5% decline every year until they're all gone, because insects are the great survivors. They've survived, you know, 5 great mass extinctions. They kind of preceded the dinosaurs and outlived them. This is probably the greatest challenge they've ever faced on their time on Earth. And it's wiping out a huge number of insects that we consider to be useful, beautiful, good to be around. There are winners and losers, though. So, you know, cockroaches and mosquitoes and some other things we're less fond of will do okay in the world we're kind of creating. So we're not going to lose them entirely. We're just going to have this radically different composition. And that, I think, when we think selfishly, has profound consequences for the amount of food we can produce, the health of ecosystems we all rely on, and so on. I don't know if there's a single point where that will become apparent. It won't be like a kind of COVID-like onset. But I certainly think, going by a lot of the predictions, by the kind of midpoint of this century, we will start seeing a serious kind of crunch point when it comes to food production, for example.
So let's now talk about the causes. And I'll just pause to ID you to my listeners. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Oliver Millman about his book, The Insect Crisis, The Fall of the Tiny Empires That Run the World. So, causes. Now, let's start with farming. Of course, prime among the causes of insects is the way we produce our food. Speaking of food, pesticides, of course. Talk about pesticides, and particularly about neonicotinoids. These seem to be among the worst culprits in the decline of insects, among pesticides of the decline.
Yeah, that's right. So neonicotinoids are a class of chemical or insecticide that is used widely across the US and increasingly other parts of the world too. They're very effective at killing insects, not just the pests that they're aimed at on crops, but everything else, every kind of bee and butterfly and beetle and, you know, everything in the soils too, worms and slugs and so on. They're very, very good at killing insects and sending them demented too. I mean, there's been studies being done on bees' brains that show that exposure to these chemicals caused them to lose their cognitive functions. They are unable to find their way back into hives. They're unable to fly as long. So it's causing this kind of widespread damage across the environment. The frustrating thing for a lot of entomologists is that these chemicals are so destructive for so little benefit. They're water soluble, so as soon as it rains, they seep out of the plants and into waterways, into the soil. And the peak of the pesticide doesn't match the peak of the pest. So they're applied early on in the growing season, but by the time summer arrives and when aphids and the other things you're trying to kill arrive, most of the neonicotinoid is actually seeped out of the plants. So it's killing a lot of insects for no real benefit, really. I mean, crop yields aren't really improved. It's been shown by any kind of dramatic degree. But farmers have been locked into this kind of cycle of continual pesticide application on their fields. I don't blame the farmers so much as big ag for doing that. The US agricultural land has become 48 times more toxic in the last 25 years. There's this continual layering of poison, and it's detrimental for pretty much everybody concerned apart from those selling the chemicals, of course.
You wrote an article in The Guardian on March 8th, I believe it was, fears for bees as U.S. set to extend use of toxic pesticides that paralyze insects. This is under the Biden administration. Of course, it first happened under Trump, I believe. There was some movement in the EPA under Obama that got undone by Trump. But the U.S. is not following, or so far has not followed the example of Europe in banning these neonicotinoids. And talk about the status of this regulation, and is it final? Is there anything that can be done to undo the harm?
Well, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, has this kind of preliminary kind of ruling. It's not final yet on what it will do with three of the worst types of neonicotinoids. So essentially, they allow their use in the US for a 15-year period. So we're coming up for another 15 years of approval of these chemicals. And it looks like the EPA will allow them for another 15 years with certain safeguards around the handling of them, and where to spray them and so on. But I mean, everybody you speak to who knows anything about this knows that there's no real kind of mitigation you can do to avoid these chemicals being picked up by insects. I mean, once they're in the pollen, they're going to be picked up by bees. I mean, that's pretty self-evident, really. So the US is a little behind when it comes to the regulation of these chemicals. The European Union, like you say, has done work on this. They've banned the three worst neonicotinoids. France has gone further. They banned it for indoor, like greenhouse use, as well as outdoor use. So, yeah, the US is kind of playing catch up a little bit on this. I think the EPA is quite aware, and they will mention this themselves, of the detrimental effects of these pesticides. But I think there's a kind of broader issue with how the US treats the approval of chemicals, not just pesticides, but in cosmetics and other areas. There is a system whereby these things are allowed through until they're shown to have caused harm later down the track when they're being used. Whereas in the EU and other places, there's a kind of precautionary principle where if you, a manufacturer, want to sell your product, you have to show first that it's not harmful. So that's the kind of state of play of where we are at the moment.
Yes, indeed. The precautionary principle is absolutely fundamental to public health, and it's something that our EPA has ignored for decades. But you also say that without other changes to the way we use land, simply eliminating pesticides could end up causing more harm to insects in the scramble to feed a growing global population. Why would it cause more harm, and how should farming change?
Well, the thing with neonicotinoids, or neonics as they're often called, is that we've got a lot of data on them and we know what they do. And they're a kind of known enemy, if you like, if you're a conservationist or a lover of bees. So if you ban them, you kind of set the clock back to zero, because there will certainly be another set of chemicals that will come in to replace them, a new set of insecticides. They might be even worse. They might be slightly better, but either way, we'll learn less about them than neonicotinoids. So you kind of take a little bit of a leap into the unknown once you make that move. The other thing about their use is that they are actually useful in certain places for increasing production. Not everywhere, but some crops do benefit from their use. And there will be a kind of huge dilemma kind of coming up that will have to be dealt with at some point, about how to feed the growing global population. Once you hit 10 billion people by the midpoint of the century, you have to feed them, and you either do that by cutting down more forests, including rainforests, to create more farmland to grow more crops, or you more intensively farm the land you have with more chemicals. Both of those options are disastrous for wildlife, including insects. You could go down other routes, such as soilless indoor farming, hydroponics, and so on. Vertical farming techniques that have been developed in some places, but it's not an easy choice. It's not an easy solution there, given the kind of dynamics of what's happening in the world. So we face some pretty hard choices. We've just got to keep insects in the back of our minds, or maybe even the forefront of our minds when we're making those choices.
I mean, there are some who say that organic agriculture is actually more productive, and that organic agriculture could take up the slack.
Yeah, I mean, in some places, the idea of regenerative agriculture, where you buy, essentially you let the ecosystem regulate itself. You don't, spray huge amounts of chemicals. You diversify your farm, so it's not just a single crop, because monocultural farming is one of the big blights on our world and has been a huge killer of insects, really. There is evidence that, yeah, if you kind of ease off on those things, you can actually improve your crop yield, and you certainly do so at far less environmental cost. The question still is, though, will we have enough land to do that with the population that we will have? Will that provide enough food? And I think that's still a kind of open question.
Another problem or another cause of the decline in insects is artificial light or light pollution. My hometown here, in East Hampton, New York, is about to put in new street lights. And activists from the local Dark Skies Initiative agitated for years and now I think successfully to make sure that these street lights are dimmable. And, when they talked about Kelvins and all kinds of things that I really don't understand, but the upshot of it is that we really need to make the night safer for insects by making it darker. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, around many kind of cities, and even kind of like suburban areas and small towns, you have this kind of not quite pitch black night situation. You have this kind of gloom, this kind of glow. It kind of feels like twilight at all times because of the amount of light pollution. And that's very harmful for insects. Fireflies, the most kind of obvious example, because they need darkness to signal to each other for mating and so on. But there are lots of other animals that really, and lots of other insects that rely very strongly on that reliable switch between daytime and nighttime. Obviously, it's hardwired into them through evolution, and what we've done is we've broken that cycle. We've broken the cycle between day and night, and that's been very harmful for insects.
And now talk about lawns. You describe what you call, and other people have also called it, the inaction plan. Not an action plan, but an inaction plan. Talk about the harm of lawns, and then maybe what we all could do to change things around a bit to make it better for the insects.
Yeah, one of the most startling facts I found out through writing this book is that lawns are the largest irrigated crop in the United States. Three times the amount of area of land is set aside for lawns than it is for corn. I mean, you don't see that all in one big patch, of course, but when you aggregate all people's front and backyards, that's what you get. It's become obviously culturally a part of the kind of American dream, the idea you would have a suburban home with a verdant lawn and a two-car garage. But that aesthetic has actually been extremely damaging for insect life. It's a desert, really, a closely cut lawn. There's nothing really there for them in terms of food or shelter. And it becomes much worse, of course, when you put chemicals on your lawn, as many people do. So people's yards are in many places very unhealthy for insects, especially if you don't have kind of native plants. So I mean, there is, but there is, a lot that people can do on a small scale to help that. I mean, let the grass grow a little bit. Don't rake the leaves in your yard because insects like to hide under that. Plant some native flowers that native pollinators will like. Have a diverse mix of stuff in your gardens rather than just a single thing, such as grass or one type of other plant. So there are things people can do. Let things go a bit. Don't be so fussy and tidy.
Or take the lawn out almost entirely and put in wildflower meadows or crops that you can eat that insects also enjoy, not necessarily eating the crop because there's always the struggle to keep them away from your food. But I'm planting flowers in around my vegetables this year so that I've got blooms for the bugs and maybe they'll leave my cucumbers alone.
Yeah. I mean, I think as much as we've become conditioned that a kind of carpet of lawn is the nicest thing you can have, and some neighborhood associations will even knock on your door, won't they, if you diverge from that. I actually think it looks much better and far less boring if you actually have those wildflowers. If you do let the grass grow, if you do let other things in, it's more colorful, it's more vibrant. It's a more lively place. You kind of walk into an area that has lots of insects and you notice it in a kind of positive way. It feels alive. And I think that's really culturally what we should be aiming for, really, rather than this kind of manicured monochrome landscape.
Oliver Millman. Stay tuned for more of our conversation about the insect crisis after the break. Bee of the Bird of the Moth by They Might Be Giants. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with journalist and author Oliver Millman about his book, The Insect Crisis, The Fall of the Tiny Empires That Run the World. Before the break, we were talking about lawns and how damaging our typical lawn care is for insects. But farmers are getting in on the act to protect insects, too. You also report on a scientist who has gone around talking with farmers, and I don't remember exactly where, but she's gone around talking with farmers about planting herbs, spices, or fruits in the borders of their fields and in unused spaces. And what can this do? And is this something that's being adopted? I mean, after all, people can make a living off of these crops as well.
Yeah, that's right. If you do that, it gives farmers a kind of diversified income. So it's not just a single crop, but also it allows space and room for insects to breathe a little bit. They actually have somewhere to forage by the side of fields. And if you connect it properly, you have this network of wildlife corridors that actually runs through agricultural land. So you have a kind of pathway to meet other insects and to mate and find other food and so on. So, yeah, it's a kind of win-win situation, I feel, if you encourage farmers to do this or even pay them to do it. They will benefit and insects will benefit too.
And you use the term pathway. I've been hearing a lot recently the term pollinator pathways. What are pollinator pathways and why is the idea of a pathway so important?
Well, I mean, one of the ways that animals, not just insects, go extinct is they become isolated and their numbers start to shrink. And obviously, you have problems with the numbers within that group, but also the genetic diversity of it. Species need a kind of broad set of genetic markers to survive and thrive. Once you cut them off into isolated pockets, then they're far less likely to make it through that kind of extinction event, really. So it's important to link up these habitats so that pollinators can mix genes to find new forage, new food, especially with climate change. Thinking about how certain areas have become less hospitable because of rising temperatures, change in rainfall patterns and so on. It at least allows insects to move slightly to avoid some of that.
And we can do this along our roadsides.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the kind of few upsides of the pandemic has been the kind of local authorities not cutting the grass by highways and other roads. I mean, it's been quite interesting to see how plants have been sprouting back up in these kind of unlikely places. And once you get them back, then you insects come back. And then when the insects come back, you have birds coming back. And suddenly you have these kind of little oases of nature in otherwise quite bereft places. So yeah, it's quite positive to see that.
I read a short story a few years ago about a future where farm laborers are paid a pittance to pollinate the orchards by hand because the insects had disappeared. You also, Oliver Millman, in The Insect Crisis, you talk about some technological solutions to, say, pollination. What's being proposed, and would it work?
Will they work? No, is a short answer. I mean, I think in some limited places, technology can help, especially if you're thinking about new forms of farming. But the idea that you could replace a bee, which has been around for hundreds of millions of years, with a robot or some kind of mechanical arm or even human labor is fanciful. There's no way we can replicate the efficiency, the kind of hard work and the kind of pure kind of pollination effects of a bee with anything else. I mean, they are quite extraordinary creatures in many respects. I learned lots of very cool things about bees in the writing of this book, and I don't think we can replace them with technology, no.
So, without banning pesticides or severely limiting their use, is there any hope that we can turn things around in time?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, I don't think it's hopeless. I think we are now more aware of the problem than we've ever been before. I think people previously kind of grasped the idea that bees were important, but now we're kind of thinking about the fact that they're disappearing, and it'd actually be very useful to keep them around. So, I think awareness is going up. You're seeing new ideas kind of come through on new farming techniques. You're seeing green roofs being planted in various kind of urban areas to encourage insects back in. You're seeing regulations come in some places, such as the EU, around pesticides. There is kind of hope there. I mean, much more needs to be done. I think culturally we need a shift as much as anything about the way we view insects and about how we interact with them and the importance we place upon them, and how, you know, how little we think of them currently needs to change. But I think there are kind of seeds of hope there that we can kind of grasp onto.
And people have proposed that we could substitute insects for meat in order to help combat climate change. You write in the book that possibly that's a good idea even on the insects' behalf as well. How does that work?
Yeah, counterintuitively, we could actually help save insects by eating them. If you think about the current model of farming we have now, it's incredibly destructive, especially when we're thinking about meat eating, and in particular beef. Raising cattle is incredibly harmful when you think of the air pollution, water pollution, effect on climate change, the fact that large areas of forest have to be cleared for pasture. So all of those things detrimentally affect insects as well as lots of other creatures too. So it'd actually be helpful for them if we switched away a bit from eating beef in particular, but also other meat, and thought about eating insects. I mean, you can raise trillions of crickets in a shipping container if you wanted to. There's very little environmental impact in doing that. You're not going to affect, you know, overall insect numbers by doing that. And insects are a good source of protein and zinc and vitamins. I mean, they've been eaten for generations in parts of the world. Obviously, in Western countries, that seems a bit icky, but we may see a kind of cultural shift on that at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually heard that crickets are quite tasty. They might even taste like chicken.
Yeah, nutty, I've heard. And you can put chili on them and, you know, flavor them. You don't have to obviously just eat them as they are. I've heard positive things about eating crickets.
So do you know of any organizations that, if listeners want to get involved and do something about basically saving our food supply, can you suggest any international or even American organizations that are working on the issue?
Yeah, the Xerces Society is the big insect conservation society in the US, named after a butterfly that went extinct in California. Talking about butterflies, there's the efforts to save the monarch butterfly, the kind of big migration of monarchs across the US into California and then down into Mexico. And there's groups like Monarch Watch that help plant milkweed and do other things to help them. Center for Biological Diversity is a good group in the US for kind of fighting for policies that help insects. There are lots of kind of different kind of environmental groups now thinking more about this. It's not a kind of sideline issue that it once was for them. But there's lots you can do yourself, of course. So if you have a backyard, you can start making change tomorrow.
And your book, The Insect Crisis, first of all, it's very entertaining to read. On the other hand, it's also the urgency. It really comes through. The Insect Crisis, The Fall of the Tiny Empires That Run the World, Oliver Millman, thank you so much for talking with us about this absolutely critical existential issue.
Thank you so much. It's been great to be with you.
Oliver Millman is the environment reporter for The Guardian. Next up, one group that's tackling the pollinator crisis, one lawn at a time. In addition to Writer's Voice, I host a monthly environmental show for my home radio station, WPKN, called Sustainable Long Island. This month, Sustainable Long Island spoke with Gail Pellett of the pro-pollinator group Change E. Hampton. They agree with our last guest that our lawn culture is poisoning us and insects in our yards, thereby threatening a habitable planet. They're calling for habitat restoration and healthy yards, which means reimagining our landscapes together with our landscapers and together with our town governments. For today's show, I've excerpted some parts of that interview with Gail Pellett, starting with talking about the devastating impact of leaf blowers on the environment and on insects.
We were just horrified by the level of use of leaf blowers in our neighborhood. This is something that everybody knows who lives in any suburban community has escalated in the last 5 or 10 years. And there's a reason that communities all across the country have been starting to work to regulate the use of leaf blowers is because they've become ubiquitous and they're everywhere all year round. And so we had, the normal, what is now considered the normal response to them, which is, of course, the horrifying noise levels, but also the pollution, the aerosol pollution that comes especially from the gas blowers. And at first we looked at the gas blowers and we thought, oh my God, we started to look up what they did. They produced 300 times the aerosols of a 2012 Ford pickup truck. They're based on a very antiquated two-stroke engine system, and they shouldn't be in use anymore, and given our concerns with fossil fuels, et cetera. But so that was easy to sort of research and understand that part of it, the threat to human health. But then what we discovered that scientists have been telling us that leaf blowers in general, not just gas, but electric blowers as well, are disturbing, disrupting, and destroying insect habitat. Because insects in the fall begin to, and I'm talking about all kinds of insects, it includes moths and butterflies and bees, start digging into that leaf and litter layer in our yards or gardens, and they are hibernating over the winter time and regenerating there. So by blowing these things out to smithereens, we are actually contributing to the catastrophic collapse of insect populations by the use of that technology. But it takes, I think, a leap for some people to think, you know, I want that all looking neat and tidy, shaved down to a, you know, an inch and not a leaf around. We're actually trying to get people to love leaves. That's one of our little slogans on our proposal.
You know, for those homeowners who say, but, you know, I don't want to have the mess of leaves and I don't want to have ticks because, of course, ticks do hide in leaves. Talk about the scheduling of leaf blowing when you do leaf blowing in order to preserve insect life.
Yes, that's really important, because if we cannot ban blowers outright today or tomorrow, we have to start looking at when they should never be used. And that is from the beginning, from the fall, when the leaves start coming down and the temperatures start cooling, insects are starting to move into that leaf layer and into the earth right below it, because it's very protected by that leaf layer. And so you have insects, as I said before, moths, butterflies, bees, using that to hibernate and regenerate. So there's a time, there should be no, actually the scientists, I'll say, there should be no leaf blowing in the fall. Let that leaf layer accumulate, let the insects have their world to regenerate. And then in the spring, after it has been 50 degrees, say, for 5 days, and we never know quite when that is, but after the earth has begun to warm and you've had a consistent warming temperature, the insects will all have come out and gone off into their lovely worlds. And then to clean up those leaves. But, you know, people like Edwina talk about, keep everything that you do in your yard on your property. In other words, you're not blowing all the leaves or even raking them and all your cuttings and trimmings and packing them off to the dump or something. She insists that what we need to do is turn all those leaves and cuttings and trimmings into mulch and earth that we can then put back into our yards and our gardens. So this takes an enormous mind change and imagination and commitment from people, and it's not going to be easy. We know that. And that's why we've focused on having the town really trying to model that behavior so that it gets more publicity and it can be more of an education and focal point for education.
Yes, that's wonderful. But just to finish the leaf thing, what you're proposing is really something that would take care of the issue of ticks. If people want to rake when it's warm, well, they're not going to, you know, most people don't really go out and use their garden all that much in the winter. And ticks are not that much of a problem in the winter. But when they are a problem, well, the ground is warm, then the insects have already flown away. So that people really could, you know, either rake or use an electric blower after the insects have gone, and they still protect themselves.
Right. That's what the scientists are telling us that is really critical. So there's a little window in that spring after that there's been a consistent period of warmth of 50 degrees, they say, for 5 days, that you can begin to clean up that garden. And we promote raking. You know, it's an aerobic exercise. You know, the woman that we are engaging with to design this pollinating garden and meadow in front of Town Hall told us a really interesting story. She grew up on a farm in New Hampshire. Her father used to take a day to rake up their large yard around the large farmhouse, etc. Well, the leaf blowers also take a whole day now to do that same task. So in terms of the argument from landscapers, the reimagination has to come first, I think, from the homeowners and the property owners to instruct what they want from landscapers. Landscapers only do what they want. But there will be resistance, you know, because once somebody falls in love with a tool, it's really hard to take it away from them.
Gail Pella told us about Change E. Hampton's campaign to teach homeowners how to make their property more pollinator friendly.
And we put together a proposal, and in that proposal, we talked about some things we were trying to promote. And that is to lessen, you know, reduce the size of your lawns, for one thing. That's something simple that all of us as individual homeowners and that have yards and lawns can do. And if you must have a little part that's lawn and you need that or you like that, make it clover, because clover retains nitrogen. And so it's a healthy thing to use as a lawn material. But we also talk about stop using any kind of chemicals or pesticides and fertilizers in your yard. And of course, to plant native plants and pollinating plants, and that way of building resiliency and bringing back insect and bird and butterfly habitat.
So you spoke before about pollinators, and you have a wonderful brochure in which you lay out your plan for the town of East Hampton, in which you take inspiration from other towns around the country that have promoted what are called pollinator pathways. So tell us about this municipal plan of pollinator pathways that you're trying to bring to East Hampton.
Well, you know, this is a train that has left the station around parts of the country, that communities around the country are beginning to promote what we call a pollinator pathway. And I just want to explain what that is first, and then we'll talk specifically about what we've been promoting to the town of East Hampton. A pollinator pathway is you take all these disjointed pieces of property that may be municipal town property, county property, they may be schoolyard or a churchyard or an individual homeowner's yard, and you want to take and transform that dead ecological zone that it currently is, that has no life left in it, and bring it back to life. And you want to create pollinator plants and things so that bees and butterflies and all the pollinating insects and birds can travel this path. And the reason to make a path where there are close by pieces of pollinating garden is because certain critical bees in our life have a very short movement span. The diameter within which they move can be very tight. And so this is why this movement has begun to take off. And there are some incredible models. If any of your listeners want to look these up, one that was an action plan that was done for Great Barrington, and another for Lincoln, Massachusetts. There are more out there, but those two are really splendid. And so when we started to get excited about this as our group Change Hampton, we are now going to present it to the town board, the idea of launching and having the town model and initiate and be a catalyst for this movement. There's already an initiative in Suffolk County where, you know, East Hampton lies in Suffolk County, but nothing yet for our town. And we want to light that fire if we can. So then we heard from the town natural resources department that they had decided to do a native garden, planting garden, on the rather large campus of Town Hall in East Hampton. And we were thrilled to hear that. And we, when we go to propose to them next month, our proposal, we want to take another chunk of that property of Town Hall, right in front of Town Hall, to do a meadow pollinating garden mix. And with the idea that this initiates a pollinating pathway from the one segment to the other segment, which is over a roadway. And we are now reaching out to churches in our community. We've already had very enthusiastic responses from schools and individuals who have supported our proposal and effort. So we're hoping to trigger the idea of a pollinating pathway.
That's so exciting. Now, give us an idea of what a pollinator, you know, what might be some plants that you might find in a pollinator pathway? And is this something that individual homeowners can also join and do?
Yes, of course. You know, there's a lot of resources out there. There are organizations that have put together, you know, ways, even organizations that if you go online and look at them, you can get a pollinating seed packet, but, you know, starting package. But they're all over the place. And we're trying to winnow it down so that we can create some toolkits for individual homeowners, for maybe church groups, et cetera, and schools, to that for people who live in slightly different ecozones, even within the confines of East Hampton Town, we have people who live closer to the ocean, closer to a wetland, and we need to have slightly different approaches.
That was Gail Pellett of the group Change eHampton. Go to writersvoice.net for links to organizations that can help you plan pollinator pathways for your property, your neighborhood, and your town. You can also find a link to my complete interview with Gail Pellett for Sustainable Long Island. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with novelists Jennifer Haig and No Violet Bulawayo. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.